I want to talk about something I've been thinking about for quite a while now, which has to do with things that we say we believe. And I've been thinking about this for a couple of years since I saw a movie that had a scene in it in which two diplomats were having an argument at the UN, and they ducked into the UN chapel to continue their argument. And at one point, one of them said, this is sacred space. And then he paused and said, now, you may not believe that, and I may not believe that, but by God, it's a useful hypocrisy. It's a useful hypocrisy. And it was one of those lines that just smacked me right in the face. You know, it's a very clever line, and it's an extraordinarily cynical line. And for me, it was kind of a shocking thing to say, in the sense that it really made me stop and think. And ever since I heard that, I've been asking myself frequently, do you really believe that? Do you really believe that? Do you really believe that? And I think it's a very useful thing to ask ourselves. You know, they're very strong words that he used in that scene, but I think that they pointed to something important that we all need to do, which is examine, you know, what we believe, what we say we believe, maybe believe what we say, but only if we really believe it. Not difficult to feel a little bit smug as Buddhists, because we are not a faith-based religion. We're not a religion that demands that we take anything that Buddha said on faith. Just the opposite, you know. He challenged us to test everything that he said against our own experience. So, you know, it's easy to get a little smug and say, well, of course, you know, in Buddhism this isn't a problem because we don't take things on faith. But I think it's a good idea to always have that spirit of spiritual inquiry alive in us. So ever since I saw that, I've been very clear with myself that I don't want any useful hypocrisies in my practice at all. And I want to try as hard as I can to avoid them. You know, in the early sutras, in the Kalama Sutra, Buddha talked about this, about the idea of faith. And he was in a small town that had a lot of spiritual teachers coming through and saying all kinds of different things, and the people in this town. And he was just another one of those spiritual teachers coming through. They didn't know, you know, him. They didn't know he was the Buddha. When he was there, some people asked him, they said, you know, we have all these people coming through telling us this, telling us that. How do we know what to believe and what not to believe? And he gave them some advice on that that was quite long, but it boils down to 3 points, I think. The first one was, he said, don't necessarily believe in something just because it's a traditional teaching. So in other words, if it's come down, you know, from years and years and years and years of teaching, don't necessarily believe that it's true because of that. And I think, I said this before, but I think that as Americans we can turn that around and say, don't disbelieve something necessarily because it's a traditional teaching. I think we have the tendency to poo-poo things sometimes just because they are traditional teachings. So anyway, the point is, don't necessarily believe or disbelieve something just because it's come down as a traditional practice and is well known and practiced everywhere. The second point that he made was, don't believe anything just because you've thought it through. And I like that one a lot. You know, he said, don't believe, necessarily believe something through logical reasoning. And that doesn't make sense to us at all, I think, in the way that, we ordinarily process these things. But he's also talking there about don't necessarily believe something just because you like the idea, just because it fits in with your worldview, just because it fits neatly into what you already believed. That, you know, we're very quick to try to make sense of our experience and try to make sense of what's going on around us. So it's very, we're very quick to conceptualize things and try to fit them in somewhere, in with the rest of our opinions. And if we hear something that fits very neatly in there, it's easy to just accept it. And in that way, we kind of limit ourselves. So, don't necessarily believe something because you thought it through. And his third one was, don't believe something necessarily because of the teacher, because just because this revered teacher said it to you. Don't get into thinking, this is what our teacher says. You know, we really need to think things through for ourselves. And more important than think things through, we need to experience the teachings for ourselves. So that's one of the famous places that Buddha talked about this. And the other place was in the Death Admonition Sutra. He said that the best way to honor him is to live his teachings. And he said it's okay to doubt and to proceed cautiously. And then the quote from that Death Admonition Sutra, where he talks about this directly, is, "Be lamps unto yourselves. Rely on yourselves and do not rely on external help. Hold fast to the truth as a lamp. Seek salvation alone in the truth. Look not for assistance to anyone besides yourselves." So Buddhism isn't about faith, but it's about action and it's about experience. So here we are in the West. And Buddhism has been established here in the mainstream, more or less, for about 50 years or so. So we're just really in the baby stages of integrating Buddhism into our culture. And we really don't have, I think, we don't have any idea at this point what Buddhism is going to end up looking like here. We don't know. We can make some pretty good guesses based on what's been happening so far, but it really hasn't been here long enough for us to say what it's really going to eventually look like. When I first joined a Buddhist Sangha in the mid-90s, I was very concerned about what was the essence of Buddhism versus what had been added via the cultures that it had come down to us through. You know, it started off in India, went through China, and took on some of the worldview and some of the cultural trappings of China. Same thing when it went to Japan, and same thing already since it's come here. And so I want to talk about two aspects of what we believe and what we believe. One is the practices that we do, and the other is the teachings. So when I first joined a sangha, I was real interested in this. You know, what's the essence versus what's been passed down through us and gotten added on. And I wrote an article about this in the mid-90s sometime. And I want to read you a little bit of what I wrote. I was very sure of myself. And that will come through. So, I started off by saying, imagine living in the same house for 1,000 years or so. Everything is in its place. You know how all the fixtures work. And the family has felt settled in for a long time. Now imagine moving out of that house many thousands of miles away. Many of your cherished possessions and ways of doing things will move with you, of course, but others will be a bit worn or seem different in the new decor. You may even ask yourself why you ever liked that particular green vase to begin with, and whose idea it was to store crayons in it anyway. So there I was talking, of course, about the forms, about the way we do things. And then I went on to talk about re-examining your practices periodically and how important it is to do that for individuals and how important it is for institutions to do that too. And the example that I gave was the missionaries who left New England and other places in the north and went to tropical climates. And November would roll around, and they would get out their long underwear and put it on because it was winter. And that's what we do. And, you know, that's something that had, for them, for these particular missionaries that I read about, had gone from being something that was necessary based on where they were to being associated in their heads in being as being godly behavior and upright behavior, and the way that the native people that they were ministering to was considered very ungodly behavior because they were dressed appropriately for the climate. I continued on in this article saying, as Buddhism becomes more firmly established in the West, it is our responsibility to maintain the true spirit of Zen as it adapts to our culture. I was pretty sure I knew what the true spirit of Zen was, having studied it for about 3 years at that time. I'm a lot less sure about that now. It's important to guard against trivializing the Dharma, especially in these days of Zen chic. But are we fully exploring the flowering of the Dharma in the West if we don't express it in ways that arise naturally from our own culture? I believe that we need to develop ways to separate core belief from what I call cultural baggage. And one of the examples of that, I think, is in terms of forms, is the kiyosaku, the awakening stick that was used in Japan to help people wake up when they were sagging a little bit during zazen. And we all heard about this, you know, the person would go around the outside of the room, and if somebody was sagging a little bit, you know, they'd get a little whack, 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 whack on the shoulders, and it would help them sit up straight and wake up. And that is a practice that was brought over to this country with the first Japanese teachers, and it's... It hasn't died out, I wouldn't say, but it's practiced a lot less frequently here. And actually, I've been places where they have used the kiyosaku, and I found it to be just what people say, that it does actually kind of wake you up a little bit. But the places that I've been where they've used it, you always asked for it. Nobody ever came around and just, you know, hit you. They came around, and if you put your hands into gassho, then they would... And actually, if done skillfully, it really does help. The problem with it is, here, I think, is that it doesn't fit very well into our culture. I was at one place where they were discussing it very, very heatedly because people who had been through abusive childhoods, even though they didn't, you know, even though it was choice whether they were hit or not, it was very upsetting to them to hear that sound going around the Zendo. And so they, I think, decided to discontinue using the Kiyosaku. So it's things like that. We have to be looking at those kind of practices and asking ourselves, you know, is this something that we're going to accept and do, or is this something that we need to take a closer look at? Then in the article, I continued with some questions that I thought might be useful or interesting, you know, to use when we were evaluating those kind of practices. And I ended up by saying that Buddhism in the West will have a different face, just as it did when it migrated from India to China and then on to Japan. And we may as well help the transition occur in a mindful way. And I think that's the key. We want to be mindful about things. We want to be mindful about which practices we retain, which practices we take up, and we want to be especially mindful about which practices we decide to jettison, because I think it can, that it's very easy to look at a traditional practice and say, oh, that doesn't work for us, that doesn't mean anything for us, poof, it's gone. I don't know if it was Suzuki or Katagiri, but one of them said, when a student asked why they taught all of these traditional forms and practices, one of them said, as I understand it, I teach it this way to you because it's the way that I learned it. And after I'm gone and after my generation of teachers is gone, you're going to have to find your own way as Americans and as Westerners to express the Buddha Dharma. I thought that was a pretty generous and confident way to express that. It showed that they really had some faith in their students, that they weren't going to just completely throw the baby out with the bathwater the minute they were gone. So I think these forms and these practices that we use have to have a level of meaning to us, but on the other hand, we shouldn't get rid of them too quickly because we can find meaning and beauty in them that we didn't know were there with time. So you can't just toss things away. And I want to add here that I'm not against traditional forms. I actually like a lot of them. So I'm not arguing against traditional forms at all. But there are things that we should look at. You know, there are a lot of places that chant in Japanese. We don't do that here, but a lot of places do. I would take a careful look at those kind of things, having been raised in a church that and during much of my childhood, all of the services were in Latin. You know, it was beautiful, and a lot of people had no idea what was going on. You know, there were pluses and minuses to it. What services look like is another thing. And maybe some of the etiquette that's come down to us that doesn't feel particularly natural to us. You know, maybe we need to think about ways that we can express some of those forms in ways that are more in keeping with what the rest of the culture is like, maybe. One example of the language is the something that we've changed here, actually, is the Dharma Talk chant, the chant that we say before the Dharma Talk. This is what we used to say. This is a standard translation that's used a lot in a lot of places. And it used to go like this. An unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. I had to go look it up, actually, because I couldn't remember it. I've got this one in my head so deeply now. But we had a lot of discussion about this and decided to change it because some of the language didn't really work for us as 21st century Americans, particularly words like unsurpassed perfect Dharma. That's not the way that we look at things. We don't want to. It goes against the idea of accepting, of blind acceptance. 100,000 million kalpas was something that needed translating all the time. It means a really long time. There's a literal meaning to it too, but it's something that, you know, anyone who came in wouldn't understand it, and it kind of set us apart in a way that maybe wasn't so useful to talk about having it to see and listen to remember and accept. I don't know. We should be thinking these things through for ourselves. I don't know that we want to just accept anything that is said here on the cushion. And I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. I think that raises the level of reverence of the teacher to a level that we don't really want to go to. It makes it sound, I think, as though the teacher is a little bit infallible. And if you think that, come talk to me at tea. It doesn't make me comfortable when I'm sitting here on the cushion myself, and it doesn't make me comfortable when someone else is. I think we need to have a little bit more critical mind than that. So we change those words, and I think that the words that we have in our chant now are beautiful and poetic, and there's something that we can say. Do I believe that? Do I buy what I'm chanting here? And the answer, I think, for me at least, is yes. So it's important to watch the words that we say, particularly in our chants and things. So those are some of the forms, or some of the examples of the forms and practices that I think about. But I've also been thinking about the teachings and things that we say, and being careful about what we say and what we think. And I came up with a list of things that I'm not sure that we always believe these, although we say them all the time. Here's one, that Zazen is beyond our conception of good and bad. Or said another way, there's no such thing as bad Zazen. You know? We say that. And yet, how many of us have said, that was just terrible Zazen. I sat there and had thoughts the whole time. And my mind was just whirling. It was like the worst Zazen ever. You know? We say that all the time. The thing is that we need to remember, the thing we need to remember about that is that the important thing about Zazen isn't the number of thoughts that come and go. You know? We can think of it as great space, but as the universe. And in the universe, there are all kinds of stars that may be showing on a particular night. You know, there may be meteor showers, there may be satellites going across the sky, but they don't affect the sky. You know, other times it may be dark out and we don't see anything, but the universe is still there. And the universe includes those clouds that are obscuring the sky. It includes the satellites. It includes the meteor showers, it includes everything, and it also includes the way that we get distracted by that stuff. So as our thoughts come and go, we want to notice that they're there, not get hung up on them, and come back to the present moment. But not do this thing to ourselves about terrible zazen versus great zazen. Because it's all, if we sit down with the intention and we do bring ourselves back, it's all zazen. Here's another one that we might not say, but we nod when somebody else says it. When we say, we are already Buddha, right now just as we are. How many times have you heard that said? And when you hear someone say it, do you think, well, maybe you are? Or certainly Dennis is. But I don't know about that other person over there. And I certainly don't know about me. You know? So, we say it, you know? Do we believe it? I don't know that we do. I don't know that we do. I'm not saying that it's wrong. I actually believe it. But I have days when it's very hard. Here's another one. Enlightenment is possible for me in this lifetime. We all have the capacity to be enlightened, not only in this lifetime, but right now. I believe that's true. And I believe it's true because I've sat a lot of retreats. And you get an experience that shows you enough of... You get sort of a peek under the covers sometimes when your mind slows down enough. We've all, I think, had these experiences where all of a sudden everything stops and the world just is what it is, beautiful and pure. It's a peek under the covers. So I think that when we find ourselves wondering about whether enlightenment is possible for me right now in this lifetime, that's something that we need to stop and ask ourselves. Do I really believe that? And am I living my life as if I believe that? Have I really explored that idea? You know, or not? Another one is the Bodhisattva vows that we chant, actually. We're going to chant them in a few moments. They're difficult for us, especially at first. You know, beings are numberless, vowing to free them. Now, there's another change in language that we've made here. The standard translation is vowing to save them, but save has connotations. So here we say vowing to free them. But, you know, that vow is saying that no matter how many innumerable beings there are in the world, I vow to free them all. And we chant that every Sunday. And I think it's a good thing to ask ourselves, do I believe that? On what level do I believe that? Can I believe that? Am I living my life as though I believe that? There are a number of different ways that you can come at them. You know, you can look at them as an aspirational vow. I look at them as I'm a human being who's taken that vow and who takes it very seriously. And if I try to think about all the beings in the world, I get overwhelmed. But what I can do is vow that the being who's in front of me right now that I'm talking to, I can be there with them. I can be totally there with them with whatever they're presenting, with whatever's coming up between us, and not run away from it. And in that way, I free both of us to be there in that moment and to not cut off who that person is. So, same thing with Dharma gates. Dharma gates are boundless, vowing to enter them. You know, it's a scary thing to think that we're going to freely enter into anything that happens to us in our lives. But on the other hand, we can vow that in this moment I will enter into what's being presented and do the best I can in that moment. And in this moment, I don't really need to worry about the moment that's going to happen 20 years from now. All I need to do is to continue practicing at this moment. So I think on that kind of level, can I say the Bodhisattva vows and really feel that I believe them? I can. The two things that I think come up a lot when we talk about things that we say that we believe as Buddhists, or that people say that Buddhists believe, I should put it in a different way, are rebirth and karma. You know, when I go out to talk to high schoolers about Buddhism, those are the two things that come up every time. So do you think you've had lots of lives, and do you think you're going to be reborn as a, you know, as a woodchuck or whatever? I'd say, yeah, if I don't straighten out and fly right, I just might. You never know. The traditional teachings on rebirth, I think, come straight out of the time that they were in. At that time, rebirth was accepted in the same way that we accept gravity today. You know, it was just, everybody knew that. Everybody knew that. And now, maybe we hold a traditional view of what rebirth is. Or maybe we take a more scientific view and say, well, you know, matter is never really destroyed, or energy, I guess, is never really destroyed. It just, you know, it keeps going and going. And maybe that works for us. When we start examining those kind of things, I think we also need to look at whether we're kidding ourselves. You know, is that just co-opting the teaching? Or is that really thinking through what I think about this? What do I think about, you know, the wheel? What do I think about the idea of, you know, we start with ignorance, and then we go through here, through here, through here, and then we end up dying and then being reborn. How does that work with my Western 21st century view of what rebirth is? I think that if we don't think through those kind of things, that we are going to end up with maybe not a shallow view of what Buddhism is, but an incomplete idea of how we can best live the Buddha Dharma. We need to really think through and experience for ourselves how we feel about rebirth, how we think karma works. I'm not saying that we need to accept what was written in the Nikayas, but we need to maybe look at what's beneath the words, what makes sense to us, what works for us, what we've experienced. And not immediately go to what I think is the cop-out of saying, well, those were very primitive people, and now, you know, we have our 21st century scientific notions that tell us da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. A lot of our scientific notions have turned out to be pretty primitive as well. So I don't mean by all of this to imply that we should be skeptical, and I also don't mean to imply that we should willy-nilly throw out some of the practices that we've used. But I think that we need to look really closely at the teachings and see where we land with them. And also talk to other people about them, because you'll get a very You know, you want to be challenged. You want to get different perspectives on this stuff. And we don't want to end up with a sort of a cold, clinical view of Buddhism, but we also definitely don't want to end up with any useful hypocrisies either, I don't think. So that's sort of a long way around of where I ended up by being sort of shocked by this line that I heard in a movie. But I'm really, it's something that I'm really interested in. You know, how we go about deciding what we believe, making sure that we check what we say we believe. Yeah, I'm really interested in that. And I'd be interested in hearing your stories or your thoughts on that. If there are things that have come up for you that you've worked through or not worked through. Yeah.
I didn't see the movie. When I heard the phrase, it had a positive aspect for me. Do I really believe that when I'm sitting in Zazen, I'm already the enlightened Buddha? Well, golly, I don't know. But it's a useful hypocrisy because it keeps me sitting.
It keeps you there.
It keeps me doing the practice. Do I believe in karma and reincarnation? Oh, wow. Those are deep questions. But if I did, then what happens when I lead my life as though I did? It's a useful hypocrisy. The Kyosaku. Wow. Deep subject. I don't think America invented abusive childhoods. I'm sure those issues came up for the Japanese.
I like the, I mean, for me, a lot of the teachings, if you could get rid of all the words, it'd be great, because the words are sticky, the semantic meanings are sticky, and that's where the fiction itself, like, grew on. I mean, I don't think a lot of people would start on the path of Buddhism if there wasn't the candy, some of the mystery and the metaphor. But I believe that, I think that peeking under the blanket is the fix for it. You have to kind of take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
I think the phrase useful hypocrisy is useful. If I'm thinking correctly, hypocrisy, like the definition is something like thinking one thing and doing or saying another thing, maybe contradictory. And I feel like in Buddhism, we're often asked to believe in two contradictory ideas or embrace two contradictory ideas at the same time. So it doesn't seem like it's much of a stretch to think that we're not going to have to do something that contradicts what we believe, you know, or say something. But we have all these contradictions.
Yeah. We embrace anyway. I call it being comfortable with paradox. And having been a Zen student for however long it's been, I've gotten very comfortable with paradox. And we need to, I think, don't know mind is really important to us. You know, that don't know. Don't know. Don't know. Let's see. Test it out. Yeah, when I heard the word hypocrisy, there was just this element of smugness to it that was really hard for me, particularly in the context of, you know, what he had originally said, this is sacred space, because I have said that before. And it's really made me ask myself, do you believe that a space could be sacred? And what is it that you're, what is it exactly that you're responding to in a space when you think of it as sacred? You know, is it the smell of incense? You know? What is it? Is it that you know that you've sat many hours of retreat in that space? Or that other people who look really pretty good when they sit up straight have done it? You know, what is it exactly? What is it? I've asked myself that a lot about sacred space, and I've come up with don't know mind. Oh, anybody else?
I like that. I like that you brought up karma and rebirth. It's very, frankly one of the things that drove me away from the faith tradition that I was raised in was some difficult concepts that I couldn't accept as being absolute reality that I apparently had to be a member of that faith. And coming into Buddhism, karma and rebirth are similar if you take them at face value. But over time, I haven't come up with a couple of nice interpretations of both of those concepts, and they appear there, of course, intimately related to one another. But for me, rebirth is the decision in this moment to do or to not do something, and it's affecting me in the next moment into which I will be reborn. So my favorite example of that is going to the coffee shop. And I've had a miserable drive, there's been a lot of traffic, and I've got this inside of me. And the clerk isn't going fast enough, and I have a choice now at this moment to clerk or not. And if I do it, in the next moment, I will fan my own flames in that moment, and in the next moment, I'll be worse for having taken that action, and as will the clerk. Because now I've thrown it out there, and this is the karma part, right? I've thrown that out there. It hits her, she takes it. Hits the next person, the next person, the world. So, in every moment, I have a choice to fan or not fan my own flames and to put positive or negative things out into the world.
I think that's a way that works for a lot of us, including me. Thank you.
I was thinking about sacred space and we lost our daughter about 10 years ago. And, we went to the cemetery from the funeral. When we got out of the car, my wife threw her shoes into the sunroof of the car and it looked like a good idea. So I took my shoes off and threw them through the sunroof. And pretty soon, so did my two sons. And we walked through that cemetery and there he. He looked at us with dismay because he was afraid we were going to cut our feet. And I said that we had to take our shoes off because I still weren't safe at home. And when you talk about sacred space, to me, it means that it's so good. And that's really all.
That's just what we talk about in Buddhism, is experiencing it directly and very deeply and profoundly. And then it's real. It's real to us. In a way that talking glibly about this is sacred space isn't. When we have that kind of experience, thank you for sharing that.